yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today, the topics of our show, one obviously must be the Trump tariff implementation. They've been talking for months, threats to impose tariffs of different amounts on China, on Europe, on NAFTA, and so forth, and it's all been pretty much talk. But now we have, as of last Friday, an actual implementation of at least $36 billion, I think it is, of initial tariffs on China. $14 billion more to come in several more weeks, I think. And of course, China says it will tit for tat impose a like amount. So now we are actually in not a trade war of words, but an actual, I don't know if I'd call it a war still. It sounds more like a spat or maneuvering, early maneuvering here for trade negotiations. So we want to talk about that and what that means. But I also want to talk once again on a topic we've addressed from time to time, and that's called the global debt surge. A recent report come out by the International Institute of Finance about global debt levels and what they mean. And of course, this global debt is related to the whole question of global economic slowdown and, of course, in turn, the trade, quote, war, unquote, because the trade war has to be viewed from the context of global economic slowdown, and debt has something to do with that. Why? Well, because if the global economy is slowing down, then we see countries, particularly the U.S. and others, start to maneuver to ensure a continuing or larger piece of the pie, the global trade pie, for their domestic economies. So trade is a reflection of the global slowdown, even anticipation of global slowdown in some cases. But in other cases, it's clearly happening everywhere. Not everywhere, but in a lot of places. The global economy cycle has reached an apex here, just as the economic recovery in the U.S. has reached an apex this year. As I've been saying many times, expect a recession U.S. and perhaps even globally in 2019, certainly 2020, but I believe in 2019 after the elections, midterm elections here. So we want to talk about global debt as well. And finally, not unrelated to the two prior topics, is the revisiting, which we will do, to the question of the U.S. tax cuts here that were implemented in January. I'm talking about the $5 trillion tax cuts for businesses, corporations, and investors in the wealthy 1%. And as I said many times, it is $5 trillion. It is not $1.5 trillion for reasons I've explained before. The justifications for these big tax cuts, more ideology than economic fact or science, are that, it will generate even more tax receipts by stimulating the economy, raising investment and jobs and so forth, and even raising government tax revenues in turn. That's the supply-side ideology nonsense. And we'll look at, is it actually raising tax revenues? And we'll look at this whole repatriation boondoggle. Multinational corporations are big beneficiaries of the Trump tax cuts. And the argument there is they will bring this money back. And by bringing it back, they will invest and stimulate the economy. And I've been saying all along, it's not going to go into real investment. It's going to go into stock and buybacks and dividends and so forth. And merger and acquisition activity. So a lot of it's going to be diverted into financial investments rather than real investments that boost the economy, GDP, jobs. And also we'll look at more specifically what's happening to real investment as a result here in the first half of the year of these tax cuts, and what we will see on all three levels here: tax revenue, receipts, repatriation, investment, and investment itself, is that what they promised would happen is not. Surprise, surprise. Okay. All right, so let's turn back and start from the beginning once again here. And let's talk about the trade, quote, so-called trade war that's been simmering since last March, when Trump brought it to a public head by announcing tariffs on steel and aluminum, if you recall, in March, particularly targeting the big steel importers to the U.S., Korea and Mexico and Germany and so forth, right? Remember that? And Canada, of course. Canada, a big aluminum importer to the U.S., and these 25% tariffs were a big issue. And, well, have they been imposed? Not really. Not yet, to any significant extent. So, you know, that's still talk. And the NAFTA trade negotiations are still talk. And Europe, of course, a lot of talk going on there. And that gets mixed up with politics as well. NATO politics and spending and et cetera, as you've been probably reading or listening to in the media and press in recent days. Well, let me reiterate some of my fundamental positions here on the so-called global trade war, Trump's trade war. All right, first of all, it's a two-track trade war. You know, there is the quote trade spat with U.S. allies. And then there's the trade dispute with China. Two different tracks. The first one, I've said all along, is phony. I don't care if they do implement a few token tariffs here and there. It's all part of negotiations between Trump trying to redo the deals to say, look, I could do better than my predecessor. So it's partly ego-driven, but it's also driven by domestic U.S. politics. The first track and the second track with China is fundamentally about November elections. Most of your pundits and the press totally miss this this connection here. Well, what's the connection? Well, Trump did quite well with this economic nationalism theme, America First, in 2016, got him elected, really. And he's been on the election path ever since, re-election path ever since. And he's focusing on mobilizing his domestic political base for the November elections, because the November elections are going to be very key for him. If he loses the House, of course, the likelihood of some impeachment proceedings will rise. If he fires Mueller, which he will do, and probably some others in the Justice Department, that will create a firestorm of sorts. He'll either do that right before or right after the November elections. If that happens, you know, and he does not have this solid Republican majority in the House, you could see proceedings introduced in the House. And, of course, the Senate is the institution that actually has the hearings on any impeachment. So he wants to maintain his majority there as well. And of course, both House and Senate are important for him to carry through the rest of his program. So lots at stake in the November elections. And he's mobilizing his economic base with this theme of America First economic nationalism, which is thus trade. He's looking tough on trade. He's talking tough. And the way his modus operandi is, he will shake up his adversaries, his opponents in negotiations with outrageous, extreme demands. And if they respond in kind, it's a signal for him to even introduce even more extreme demands. He will not be outflanked on extremity. And at first, the oppositions did not realize this and responded aggressively, just as aggressively for their domestic political reasons. And Trump kept one-upping them. But there's some signs that all of them are beginning to realize the game and how it's played. The Chinese are, Germany is, Merkel is. And, instead of escalating the talk in response to his escalation, they downplay it. Well, look at just recently elected President of Mexico, López Obrador. You know, he's very cleverly here, not antagonizing Trump, in fact, throwing out some olive branches, and Trump likes that. Makes him feel he's really in control and the more powerful, and that's important to him in his negotiating style. Mexico has only responded with, what, $2.5-3 billion in tariff? That's tokenism, you see. That's not real. All parties among the U.S. and the allies are engaging in token responses as far as trade is concerned here, even Europe. That doesn't mean that, there may be some trade action and tariff action on both sides, but, you got to look like you're doing something if you want negotiations. I don't see anything really that one might call a true trade war with the U.S. and its allies. The template is South Korea. You see, South Korea has always been one of the biggest importers of steel to the U.S. And look at the deal Trump negotiated with them earlier this year. Pretty much they can keep importing all the steel they want. Just some token quotas on auto and truck sales and so forth. It was really a joke, And if that's the template, then one can expect NAFTA negotiations to be token as well. Now, token means Trump needs something out of the deal to be able to go to his domestic political base and say, hey, look what I did. And of course, he'll exaggerate and lie the hell out of it and make it look like he's done something really significant. Well, it's actually going to be very, very minimal. There'll be some change. They're tweaking the NAFTA deals. Just as they will tweak the deals and negotiations with Europe, right? Now, in the case of Europe, what Trump is doing is using the trade issue as well to leverage getting the Europeans to pay more for NATO, see? That's one of his pet peeves that he ran on. You know, everything he's doing has to be seen in line of his campaign promises and his desire to run again. Right? So all this NATO stuff is related to that. Also, if you've been watching the past week with his discussions and declarations and tweets regarding NATO in Europe, he's kind of attacking Merkel in Germany. And what he's really upset about there is Merkel in Germany won't go along with some of his political objectives elsewhere in the world, particularly in the Middle East. And he, of course, in his recent visit there, brought up this question of why is Germany about to buy all this natural gas from Russia? And of course, he exaggerates that 2/3, he says, of their natural gas is coming from Russia. Well, it's about 10%, actually. But there is a pipeline being built from Russia to Germany. And that kind of irks the Americans because the Americans now have all this excess of natural gas from fracking in the U.S. and they want to sell it to Europe, even though it's more expensive than Russian natural gas. And they're trying to force the Europeans to purchase that. I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't tied in with NATO defense spending increases. You know, Trump may let them go on some of that if they agree to buy more U.S. natural gas. And, of course, by exporting our natural gas, it will raise the price of natural gas here in the U.S. Already there's so much excess natural gas that it's keeping prices low, and therefore the profits of energy producers in the U.S. lower than they would like that to be. So there's a double hit by selling more expensive natural gas to Europe and at the same time raising the price of natural gas here in the U.S. And Trump is carrying that water for them. You know, they like that. They like the maneuvering going on by Trump to reestablish and enhance the hegemony of U.S. Capitalists globally here. That's what's going on under Trump, you see. What happened under Obama was that the neoliberal policy regime established by Reagan collapsed, and Obama couldn't put it back together again, and what we're seeing is it being put back together again by Trump. By the way, my next forthcoming book at the end of this year is going to be an explanation of neoliberalism, both domestic and trade and dollar and currency, in other words, external international economic policy as well as domestic policy. Most analyses of neoliberalism focuses on austerity and so forth, but they don't incorporate neoliberal international economic policy as integral to neoliberalism. Well, this book coming out will be about neoliberal policy and its evolution from Reagan to Trump. Trump should be viewed as neoliberalism 2.0, an attempt to reestablish it in an even more virulent form to impose U.S. hegemony for another decade at least over foreign competition and domestic sources. That's why there's such a new attack on labor going on. Democratic rights and any sources of resistance domestically, and at the same time we have this trade aggression by the U.S. under Trump. Neoliberalism always has a domestic and an international element to it, an economic and a political element to it. Well, in my book, Neoliberalism from Reagan to Trump, you know, I'll be describing the evolution of these policies, domestic and political, from Reagan to the crisis under Obama, and now the resurrection of it in more aggressive form under Trump. And of course, that's the trade aggression that we're seeing with Trump. Another thing too that's interesting, and I'll soon be posting on my blog, jackrasmus.com, my latest published article for a publication out of Beijing, and that is if you look at policies on the domestic front and the international front, in other words, the trade front and so forth, you know, what you see is that Trump trade policies are really a response, a reaction or response, a natural logical consequence to domestic policies, Trump domestic policies. Well, let me explain this very briefly. We got these massive tax cuts under Trump, right? Yep. And we have domestic social program cuts coming even more. War spending, defense war spending, escalating $100 billion a year. So, you know, those are classic neoliberal policies, increased war defense spending and more corporate investor tax cuts. Well, those two elements, as I've said in previous shows, are really throwing the U.S. deficit out of whack. Over $1 trillion a year in annual deficits and increases to the U.S. national debt are on the agenda. That's over $1 trillion a year. And if we have a recession, it'll be even more. And of course, we will have a recession in the next 10 years, sooner rather than later. Okay, so you have $12 to $15 trillion in new additions to the national debt that are coming because of the tax cuts and war spending increases. That's baked in already. Well, that means the Federal Reserve, the central bank, is going to have to sell a hell of a lot more bonds to cover that deficit and that debt. Well, to sell that much more, it's got to raise interest rates. the yield that it will pay if investors buy those bonds. That's why rates are going up. It's because central bank interest rates and other rates are going up because of the need to finance that $1 trillion plus a year deficit. That's the sole reason. Okay, so what does that have to do with trade? Well, just this. If interest rates go up, the dollar goes up. If the dollar goes up, other currencies go down. That's just the way currency exchange rates work. And the dollar is on a trajectory of continued increase, just as interest rates are rising continually. Now, if the value of the dollar goes up, U.S. good exports become less competitive to foreign exports. In other words, by raising interest rates and the dollar, the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot when it comes to maintaining its share of global trade that's already shrinking, or about to shrink, slowing down. Okay, so what does the U.S. do? It goes on a trade offensive, you see? There's this chain, this relationship between tax cuts, neoliberal tax cuts, neoliberal war defense spending, neoliberal deficits, national debt, dollar rising, rates rising, becoming less competitive on the trade front, and these trade responses. So it's natural that this trade offensive follows the big tax cuts and defense increases. This isn't the only time this has happened. Under Ronald Reagan, the same thing happened. When Reagan came into office, he raised interest rates significantly, much higher than today. That drove the dollar up and destroyed the U.S. Trade balance, especially with Japan, which was on a pretty good increase, aggressive increase, gathering, you used to call it Japan Inc., gathering its share of global trade. Well, under Reagan, the answer was a new trade offensive that followed the Reagan tax cuts, that followed the Reagan defense spending in his first term, which destroyed the U.S. budget deficit and started raising the debt. That's why there was a Reagan trade offensive targeting Japan. Now, in my articles I'll be posting on my blog here starting Saturday. Please do read it. You know, called Trump's Deja Vu Trade War. In other words, I'll compare the current Trump trade war to the Reagan trade war. Very similar. That's part of neoliberalism. And by the way, it's pretty much the same thing that Nixon did in the early 70s, targeting Europe, when he established what he called his New Economic Program, which really targeted trade with Europe by devaluing the dollar eventually, but also giving tax cuts and spending, war spending increase. Again, tax cuts for corporations, war spending, both which exacerbate the deficits and debt, which raise interest rates, which raise the dollar, which makes U.S. exporters uncompetitive, therefore generating this intervention on trade policy. Happened under Nixon, happened under Reagan, happening again under Trump. It's the nature of neoliberalism that whenever they intensify their tax and fiscal policy and raise interest rates, monetary policy, they have to respond with trade policy. And that's what's happening once again as Trump attempts to reestablish a new neoliberal hegemony and U.S. Capitalist domination over foreign competitors as well as domestic. Okay. So which brings us back to the Trump trade offensive here. As I said, to summarize, there's a two-track trade dispute going on, one with China, one with the rest of U.S. allies. The U.S. allies will be token. Who knows where the trade war with China will go, however. That could slip into a trade war, but it's not there yet. And second thing to keep in mind is the role of domestic U.S. politics. Third, South Korea is the template, probably, for NATO and Europe. NATO will be resolved here before the election, I predict. Europe, not so quickly, because Europe's in deep trouble of its own, can't get its own act together. In the U.K., is there going to be a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit turning into chaos? It may be neither. Yeah. And then, of course, Europe is having its own troubles. Merkel and the Germans are losing their influence relative as the other EU countries rebel against German hegemony within the EU. And, of course, the thing to watch is Italy right now, both politically and economically. Italy just may disrupt the whole picture here. Okay, so we'll keep watching those, but you know, a potential for a trade war exists with China. Well, why do I say that? Because there are three big issues with China. The U.S. has. Okay, one issue is the U.S., particularly bankers and multinational corporations, really want to own their own production facilities in China. They want more penetration and ownership of operations. You see, up to recently, China required a majority of China ownership of all production in that country. Well, you know, they want 51% or 100% U.S. corporations, and the bankers too. The bankers want more penetration to China because there's a lot of deals to be made and a lot of fees, and multinational corporations want to own their operations in there. So access to Chinese markets is one big issue for the U.S. or in this whole trade spat going on here. The other is, you know, China has a $470 billion surplus for goods trade with the U.S. By the way, the U.S. has a $100 and some billion surplus for services trade with China. So it's not as if the U.S. is on the short end of the stick. You know, if they sell more services there, you know, they could offset the goods deficits. But, you know, $475 billion is not an insignificant amount. The U.S. Wants to be able to sell more goods into China to reduce that goods deficit of $475 and or to reduce China exports to the U.S., in goods. All right, so that goods export trade balance, trade deficit is something, as well as market access. The third area of concern for the U.S. has to do with technology transfer. Sometimes it's euphemistically phrased in terms of intellectual property, but it's really technology transfer. Last year, China came out with a statement called China 2025, where it wanted to dominate globally the new technologies, the key new technologies, 5G, wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. These three are going to transform the global economy in the next decade and transform military power. So the U.S. defense establishment, defense companies and Pentagon intelligence agencies are concerned about that issue. They're concerned that China is requiring too much tech transfer for companies, U.S. doing businesses there, and that China is on a binge to try to buy up companies in the U.S. that have some technology significance for them. So the U.S. defense establishment wants some changes there. So there's three main issues with China: tech transfer, market access, and goods deficit. Now, these three issues aren't really at play in the other countries that the U.S. is, quote, negotiating right now with trade relationships. Well, maybe you might say in the case of Mexico or even Canada that the goods flow deficit is something of an issue, but certainly not the tech transfer. And certainly not the market access. You see, when you got a free trade agreement like NAFTA, you have all the market access you want for your for your multinational corporations. That's a lot of what free trade is about. You see, it's market access. It's not goods traveling back and forth between countries. Okay, so you know, there's some issues in the China relationship that don't exist elsewhere. And of course, China is the only player capable of really challenging the U.S. in the longer term, militarily, politically, and economically on a global scale. Right? Russia has been pretty much driven back within its own borders. There's a few forays here and there in the Middle East and so forth. You know, Russia is not on the advance, you might say, globally as a threat to the U.S. China could become, you know, China and the South Sea Islands and so forth could disrupt or control trade routes that the U.S. considers its backyard. So China is more of a target here. Right? Now, these three areas, the three issues, are reflected in the U.S. negotiating team, as I've said before, and I've written about. Read the articles on my blog, the series, three-part series, two of which have been written on jackrasmus.com and on other public blogs. Right? The three issues being access to markets, goods trade balance, and tech transfer. If you look at the U.S. negotiating team, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, former banker, Goldman Sachs, right, has been leading the negotiations for the U.S., going over there back and forth and accepting his Chinese equivalent quietly, you know, to Washington, where they're negotiating and have pretty much come to deal on matters that relate to market access. The Chinese have already conceded 51%. Ownership allowing U.S. corporations. Steve Mnuchin thinks it's a good deal. He's even said, oh, wow, great progress. You know, we're happy with it. The banker's getting what they want. Multinationals getting what they want, you know. And recently, Elon Musk here, right, is opening, announced he's opening up a big factory in Shanghai here for electric cars, right? 100% owned by his company. He likes that, right? So the Chinese are making these major concessions to split the U.S. factions on the U.S. negotiating team. Faction being the bankers and multinationals who are getting what they want already. Another faction being represented by Larry Kudlow here in the Trump administration, you know, buying more stuff from the U.S. and allowing the U.S. to sell more stuff, goods, into China. Signals being given there by China already. It's willing to do that significantly, $200 billion. Well, that's an appeal to Trump's base, Midwest base, particularly agricultural base. Right? So the signals are there. Of course, at the same time, China must do a little bit of a tit-for-tat if the U.S. imposes tariffs. It notifies or indicates tariffs of its own. But that's all tactical negotiating stuff. The big signal is, well, we've already agreed to buy tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions more from you, America. That's a big win, you see, for Trump when he goes back to his base saying, see what I did? The third faction, though, is the faction of the defense establishment. Right? And the hardliners there, they're called representing those interests on the U.S. negotiating team have been Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, and this guy Peter Navarro, a real radical right-wing anti-China, anti-anything that smacks of not extreme right-wing. So, you know, he's been anti-China for some time, this guy Navarro. He's on the team, too. Well, Mnuchin threw him off the team a couple months. But then, you know, the defense industry folks retaliated through Congress, right? And they almost gave the deep six to this ZTE Corp, Chinese company trying to buy up in the U.S. You know, Congress got active and and the defense lobbies and so forth. And, you know, they almost gave that a deep six, and Trump came to a compromise on it. So they are still very much trying to get back in the game and demanding in any final negotiations that there must be some big concessions by the Chinese on intellectual property, meaning tech transfer, corporate buying corporations in the U.S., and at the same time, tech transfer companies in China. Right. So the nature of the negotiations with China are quite different than with the other countries as far as trade is concerned. And we could have a true trade war erupt in the case of China. Right? We'll see how it goes. But China, you know, very clearly is giving signals it does not want a trade war, even though it does have some strengths in negotiations with the U.S. It has some weaknesses as well, right? So what are these China strengths and China weaknesses, and what are the U.S. strengths and weaknesses in relationship to China? Well, first of all, China has some negotiating cards here. It is a big buyer of U.S. treasuries and bonds. If it even slowed down the purchases of those bonds, it would have an effect on raising U.S. interest rates. In other words, if the Chinese stopped buying bonds, the Federal Reserve, in selling bonds, would have to sell more to other people besides China, and therefore would have to raise interest rates even further. So the China could play that card and slow down its bond buying from the U.S. Of course, that doing that would cause a further devaluation of its currency eventually, because raising the rates would, you know, raise the value of the dollar and decrease, devalue the value of the yuan, right? Which is another strength that it has. You see, the dollar is still king globally here, especially since Europe is in such a funk, and therefore the euro has lost some of its influence. The yuan is not equivalent yet. China would like the yuan to become a global currency, but we're years, maybe decades away from that. That's not happening overnight. Nonetheless, if China, which has been keeping its currency within a narrow trading band and stable in relationship to the dollar, if China decided to allow it to devalue, and there's pressure already to allow it to devalue, right? As the U.S. raises rates, lowers the yuan exchange rate, the yuan is now against you know, the upper band, upper limits of the band that it tries to keep it within, and it's pressing to devalue. Well, if it allows it to devalue, you see, what happens is that now there's clearly a currency war globally that's going to erupt. And we will see all these other currencies already declining in value to the dollar decline even more. And we'll talk about that as we have. That causes a currency flight from these currencies countries. And we would see currency flight from China erupt once again. That was a big issue when the 2015 China stock market collapsed. A lot of the investors wanted to take their money out of China altogether, so they take it and try to buy other currencies, which drives down the value of the yuan even further, get their money out of China, invest it elsewhere in the world. China had to impose some pretty strict controls over currency outflow from its country. It successfully did that. But, you know, if the U.S. Really imposes 10% tariffs now on another $200 billion threat that Trump has levied here, you know, as he imposed last week the $36 billion, he pretty much gave a signal to China, you do a tit for tat, we're going to have another $200 billion. Well, the $200 billion is just talk. But if it was $200 billion, 10% tariffs on $200 billion, you know, China could respond by allowing its yuan to decline 10%, which isn't all that much, you see, and offset the 10% tariffs. Now, that means we would be in a true trade war. In other words, to sum up here a little bit, The true trade war begins when you have a currency war. Yes, the currency war, when it begins, will be a signal that the trade war has become real. Not yet. And of course, not yet. And you know, look at investors in the stock markets and everything. Yeah, the pundits and media talk about it. They're all concerned. But investors are just sort of sitting back waiting to see. They're not convinced this is a real trade war yet. It's got some potential to be, particularly in China. You know, but it's not really had a big negative impact on investment yet. Okay, so China's strength is its currency. If it allowed it to devalue, you know, that this would allow it to offset any trade tariffs imposed by Trump, 10%. Trump would then have to impose even greater tariffs. That's why we would be in a greater trade war. You know, if there were 10, 25% tariffs on $250 billion of Chinese goods, that's a trade war. And that would set off a currency war globally. Of course, the currency devaluating the yuan wouldn't be all that great for China either, because China's trying to create the image globally among all possible investors in China, other capitalists elsewhere, that it's stable, that its currency is stable, and it's good to invest in China. You know, no investor wants to invest in a country where the currency is falling because the value of your investment collapses. No one wants to do that, lose profits because of simply a currency exchange rate changes. So they become reluctant. Well, that's why stable currency is very attractive. And China wants to keep investment flowing into China from elsewhere in the world. And to do that, it has to keep the currency stable within that band. Well, but if the Trump forces their hand, they may allow it to devalue. Or if the dollar just keeps rising because the Fed keeps buying more bonds and has to raise its rates, the dollar will go up. Well, China may not be able to, even if it doesn't want to, prevent a devaluation of its currency. So that's a source of Chinese, it's a card the Chinese can play in negotiations, in other words. Another card is China can reorient more to the European Union. It's doing a lot to try to invest in Europe, particularly Eastern Europe. And as that economy gets weaker, Europe's going to become more receptive to more Chinese investment. Russia, of course, has a growing relationship there economically, South Asia. So it could turn, China could turn to offset these U.S. tariffs. It could turn to elsewhere in the world because its goods are being bought around the world, and it is a buyer of commodities around the world. Okay. China could also turn to more, once again, government domestic real investment to keep its economy going above 6%. It's done this many times in the past. When it looks like it's weak, the government just jumps in and more government investment spending. You see, the investment spending by the U.S. government is very, very small in the U.S. But in China, at times, it's been 30, 40%. Well, it could make up the export loss because of the tariffs by just stimulating domestic infrastructure spending and therefore gross domestic investment further as well. China, of course, given its political system, the leadership can move much more quickly than in the U.S. And make these shifts and changes. So these are China's strengths in this negotiation with the U.S., and the weaknesses, of course, are, as I said, with the devaluation, it's not all strengths and no weaknesses. China's stock market is showing signs of instability right now. China has a tremendous amount of debt and financial instability. It's prone to that in its local government, in its state-owned enterprises, property markets, and so forth. And those could be destabilized if a true trade war occurred. And of course, it has a larger amount of goods trade surplus with the U.S. The U.S. has virtually, quite small in terms of goods. goods trade. China is clearly the winner on the goods trade. So, as the U.S. negotiators say, it has more to lose than the U.S. Well, that's just looking at quantities of traded goods as the key, and I'm not so sure that's the key. This thing is so globally strategic, economically and politically, that I don't think simply a good surplus of $475 billion is the key factor necessarily alone, right? And China still needs U.S. tech technology. It's at a disadvantage with chip technology, commercial aircraft, and so forth. It still wants these things from the U.S. And my sense is China would consider a true bona fide trade war with the U.S. premature at this time. And I think Trump knows that, you see. And U.S. negotiators are counting on that. The U.S. strengths, of course, are the economy at the moment is relatively strong compared to the past, but it's not going to be next year, 2020, so they've got to move now. Inflation is still not runaway or very high in the U.S., about 2%, right? They're still showing jobs being created in the U.S., even though they are low-pay, low-quality jobs. The U.S., the dollar is still king and globally. So the U.S. Feels now is the time to force China's hand. And all this coincides nicely with Trump's domestic politics, you see. And that's why we have this thing going on here. Okay. So China's response now is concessions to U.S. bankers and multinationals. Concessions signaled for buying more goods from middle America, particularly agriculture, right? And it's making appeals directly to U.S. multinational corporations intervene here with Trump and not let this thing become a real trade war. And, of course, the U.S. Capitalist groups are responding. Chamber of Commerce and others, are sending letters to Trump. We don't agree. We think you're taking a big risk, blah, blah. But that's not going to stop Trump. Trump is looking at his politics, his base, and the elections. And particularly if Mueller comes out with an indictment of some sort, he's going to really agitate, mobilize that base. He's got to show he's doing something good for them, even if it's disputable that he is. All right, let's turn to the second topic we identified here, and that is global debt. The International Institute of International Finance just published some data that shows $250 trillion in global debt. Right? 318% of global GDP. More than three times the size of global GDP, which is about 70 to 80 trillion global GDP, three times the debt. As I've said in previous shows, it's not just the debt level, but it's the ability to finance the debt that is critical. My book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy, really brought that out. You can talk about debt, and it is important, but it's not the whole show. If the economy is growing and incomes are growing, whether they're household debt, whether it's government debt, whether it's business debt, it doesn't matter how much debt you got. But when the income growth stagnates and declines, then you got a big problem with the level of debt and refinancing that debt. Okay, so what does household income growth, where does that come from to finance household debt? It comes from wages and jobs. Well, that's been pretty stagnant, you see. So households are becoming, as I say, more fragile when their income is not able to service their debt. What about government? What's it? It's income. Well, tax revenues is its income. Well, that's not rising. In fact, that's growing. It's not rising. It's falling, as we will show shortly. So government's becoming more fragile, ability to finance the debt. And corporations and banks, finance and non-finance corporations, are the big the big debt increase source here. Most of the debt that's increased since 2008 has been corporate debt. Corporate debt, yes, borrowing, issuing commercial paper, issuing corporate bonds, junk bonds, triple B bonds, investment grade bonds, whatever, which was made, nicely enticing by the Federal Reserve's low interest rates. Well, it's a big problem, the debt level here, and so far, the ability to finance it growing more difficult for government and households. Not more difficult for businesses because their profits and their sources of revenue have increased significantly. So they've been able to finance that debt. But if you have a recession, you see, then the corporate, non-corporate, non-financial corporation sources of liquidity, as they call it, to pay for that debt dries up. Then you got a big crisis. Well, $250 trillion now, the level. But also the trend is really alarming here. $25 trillion global debt increase in just the last year, according to this International Institute of Finance. And in 2018, it's growing at an annual rate of over $30 trillion. So it's accelerating. The level and the rate of change is accelerating. And most of it is non-financial corporate debt. And government debt, non-financial corporate debt. You see, in 2008, it was financial corporate debt. Now it's mostly non-financial corporate debt. Well, when debt rises that much, then corporations loaded with debt have to refinance it at some point. And a big amount of refinancing is coming up. But to refinance it, they got to borrow more dollars to refinance it and to refinance their trade. You see, when their currency declines, they've got to borrow more to finance trade. Borrow more of what? In dollars. Because most of the global trade is done in dollars, you see. It's in fact, in places like Latin America, it's been virtually all dollarized debt. So if the value of the dollar rises, they've got to borrow more dollars, which accelerates their debt increase in order to invest in their countries or to finance their trade. And if interest rates in the U.S. for the dollar rise, then they must pay more for the increased amount they borrow. Well, they become even more indebted. You see, debt begets debt in this case and begets a hell of a lot more when there's a crisis. But you can't always get it when there's a crisis, and that makes it a double crisis, right? So the foreign demand for U.S. dollars increases, and that exacerbates the already trend, a problematic trend of rising U.S. dollar and declining currencies around the world, currency values, right? And when you got declining currency values, right, it leads to stock market declines in those countries, leads to capital flight, right? Leads to more import inflation. Currency devaluation is a real boogeyman here for the rest of the world, not for the U.S., because the U.S. controls global currencies through its dollar. It also means emerging markets then have to raise domestic interest rates to check the capital flight and the import inflation, and that leads to recessions while inflation is rising. We call that stagflation. You can see this happening, and we've talked about this on previous shows here, with Argentina, with Turkey, with Brazil, now South Africa, Indonesia, and even China, right? Non-financial corporate debt in just the emerging market economies is now at $32 trillion. And they've got to refinance that. Where are they going to refinance $32 trillion? At rising rates and with a declining currency. Emerging markets are really on the edge of the cliff, you might say. The dollar rises significantly more. It could just push them over the cliff. But the dollar's got to rise because interest rates have to rise to finance the to $15 trillion of more deficits coming because of Trump tax cuts and war spending. You see how this is all linked together, isn't it? The whole world is linked together by all these economic variables, and at the center of it is this crazy neoliberal policy of the U.S. Okay, last topic here is the tax cuts, this $5 trillion Trump tax cuts, right? The fiction that it would lead to more tax receipts, revenues from the U.S. if they cut these taxes. Right? The argument is it leads to more investment, therefore more jobs, and therefore more economic activity, and therefore more tax revenues. This is supply-side ideology nonsense, right? Okay, so what are the facts? Well, you look at what's called the FRED database of the St. Louis Federal Reserve District, right? What's happened to government tax receipts here in the first half of 2018 once this Trump tax thing went into effect? Well, they've fallen almost, corporate tax receipts have fallen almost by half. Not increased, they've fallen by half. The average ongoing, you know, in throughout 2017 was $410 billion about. Now it's $270 billion. Just take a look at the FRED database. You know, go type in F-R-E-D, St. Louis, Federal Reserve District, federal government tax receipts. Wow, $270 billion. Fallen, you know, $150 plus billion. Over the averages in 2014, 16, 17, tax receipts are going down significantly. All right, another argument is that it's going to lead to investment, real investment. I've been saying, no, it's going to go into stock buybacks and dividend payouts and mergers and acquisitions. Well, stock buybacks, dividend payouts have been averaging $1 trillion a year for 6 years. Well, now they're going closer to $1.5 trillion this year. S&P 500 buybacks in the second quarter of 2018 alone were $436 billion in buybacks, which is almost twice the first quarter's $242 billion. This is where this stock, I mean, these tax cuts are going. They're going into buybacks and dividend payouts. They're also going into mergers and acquisitions. A record level now, first quarter of 2018, 2017, we're total about $1.6 trillion. Now it's $2.5 trillion. It's going into buying up companies. It's going into paying stock dividends, keep their stock up. You know, that's where all this is going. It's being diverted. If you look at global U.S. and global in real asset investment, it's called capital expenditures, right? First quarter of this year, 18%, running at an 18% increase. Third quarter, the projection by the banks is 10%. Fourth quarter, 1.7%. In other words, business spending got a little boost this year, and it's going to flatten out by the end of the year. Small business is even worse. Fourth quarter, it's projected to be an 11.7% decline in capital spending. The big boost, you know, for the U.S. economy is clearly dissipating. That's one of the reasons I say by the 2019 it's going to be another recession. So the tax cuts are either being hoarded, not going into investment, right? Or they're going to stock buybacks and dividend payouts or mergers and acquisitions. And it's not going to the U.S. Treasury because the tax revenue receipts are declining, which is means that the annual deficits and debt are going to be even bigger than they're projecting. Well over $1 trillion. Okay. Next week, I'm sure we'll have some interesting fiction to talk about in the global economy. Polish now, walk the streets.